Welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner for Friday, October 3rd, 2014. I'm Sam Minter. We have no Yvonne Bo this week. Yes, Yvonne Bo called me, or texted me, I guess, a couple hours before we were scheduled to record our show, saying that he was once again traveling, and once again he was in a place with a very unreliable cell signal, and apparently even the landline in his hotel was broken. So basically, doing a show wouldn't have worked very well. And I guess he had so Wi-Fi at the hotel, but it was also intermittent and spotty and sucky, and I'm sure he wasn't thrilled about that stuff. But in any case, that meant no Yvonne. I posted on Twitter asking if anybody wanted to co-host. No responses this time. So, and I didn't go after anybody in particular this time. Just the generic, hey, anybody want to join us? And no answer. I feel so unloved. that means it is just me. So, usual warning I give in these situations, if you are one of those people who is not particularly fond of the solo shows, tune out now. It's okay. I forgive you. We'll talk to you next week. In the meantime, I am going to be chatting on a little bit on my own. The topics today, I'm going to talk a little bit about the Sam Wang, Nate Silver nerd fight over senatorial models for predicting what's going to happen with the Senate in the election that's now just about a month away. I'm going to talk about the Secret Service and presidential security, because that's been coming up. Ebola. And podcast speeds. How you listen to podcasts, whether it's, you know, okay to listen at an increased speed, or whether that somehow is insulting to the podcaster. I got into a little Twitter fight about that earlier this week. Spoiler, I come out in favor of speeding up your podcasts, including this one. Feel free to speed up this podcast. Okay, well, let's just jump right in. And by the way, as you can tell, I mentioned it's Friday, October 3rd. It's just after 13, it's about 1330 UTC, a couple minutes before 1330 UTC, which is much later in the week than I usually do this. I've gotten up early on Friday morning to do this podcast before anybody else in the house wakes up, and before we take Alex to school, and before I go to work, and all of that kind of stuff. So we'll see if I can get through this before everybody wakes up. I kind of doubt it, but you know, we'll see how it goes. Anyway, Sam Wang and Nate Silver. Look, here's the deal. There are all kinds of forecasts out there with all kinds of people doing poll-based stuff or poll plus models or whatever to try to predict the results of the elections in November. And they all use slightly different methodologies. And, you can make arguments for or against any of these methodologies. Now, what Nate Silver seems to be particularly sort of calling out Sam Wang and saying that his models, well, are basically shit. Okay. Here's part of his argument. And like, he posted something on October 2nd at Political Wire. Interesting, he didn't post it at his own 538 publication, but whatever. And he points out that you've got a whole bunch of these models, and they're relatively similar to each other, most of them. So we got 538 says Republicans have a 59% chance of winning the Senate. Huffington Post puts them at 58. New York Times, 63. Daily Kos, 66. Charlie Cook, 60%. PredictWise, 64. Betting Markets at 67. Washington Post at 78. Meanwhile, Sam Wang's model, all on its lonesome, has the Democrats favored with Republicans only having a 38% chance of winning the majority. Nate Silver in this latest thing called Nate Silver Rebuts Sam Wang, you know, basically is pointing this as, is not just, you know, Nate Silver versus Sam Wang, it's Sam Wang versus everybody else. Now, a couple things I'd like to point out, and Sam Wang has posted a bunch of stuff on his blog at Princeton Election Consortium. Is that what it is? I'll get the right name in a second. That's close. It's PEC. Princeton Election Consortium. Anyway, he's posted a bunch of stuff explaining his methodology and how he gets the results he has, and, you know, being very open, releasing the source for how his analysis is, and, you know, and rebutting some of Nate Silver's points, and Nate Silver in turn has rebutted some of his points. And there are two things. One, of course, I like seeing, you know, the more openness on these models, the better, you know, the more that you know, and that's something that Nate Silver doesn't give every single detail of his model. There's some bits that he keeps to himself, I guess, although I think he's eventually released most of these things. But in any case, excuse me. It's good to have these competing models because it helps give you sort of the range of possibilities whereby you can interpret this data. And if you do read the details of what Sam Wang has posted, oh, okay, that sounds reasonable that you do it that way. And then you read Nate Silver's rebutting of it, and you're like, oh, you're right. He's got some points onto why this is bad. And why Sam Wang is doing some things in a way that maybe, you know, in his latest criticism, Nate Silver basically says, look, you're allowing too much volatility based on the way you're averaging it. Sam Wang does two things: snapshots that are basically if the election was held today. And then he also constructs a forecast, and he builds the forecast based on how much variation you're seeing in the in the daily snapshots. And so so Nate Silver argues a few things. One, the snapshots themselves are extremely volatile, and so you probably should be doing some additional smoothing or something on those daily snapshots. And two, the way that he is projecting forward from the snapshot to the general election prediction perhaps allows for too much volatility as well, so that if you have a snapshot today that looks more beneficial to the Democrats, that gets magnified for the prediction for November. Okay, all of these are potentially legitimate points. There are a few things that I think of when I see these, though. One is, again, I like the debate. I like having these things open. Hearing the back and forth on this actually lets me have a better sense of exactly what's going on, at least with Sam Wang's model, both with Sam Wang's detailed descriptions of what he's doing and with Silver's critiques of them. That's awesome. I wish I saw the same level of critique on all of these other models, including Nate Silver's himself. But at the same time, Nate Silver's being a dick. Okay? That's the simplest way to put it. Nate Silver is being a dick. He could have some of these criteria, some of this criticism and back and forth and blah blah blah, but do it in a, you know, sort of civil, collegial, constructive point of view. And I think it's really Nate Silver who's been, it's almost like he has it in for Sam Wang. Like, you know, because, and admittedly, you know, Sam Wang has criticized Nate Silver's methods as well and blah, blah, blah. But look, here's the deal. Nate Silver managed in, I guess, 2008. 2008 was the first, and I guess it was the first year Nate Silver was really doing it too. And he managed, it in a very sophisticated way, and some journalism.
Obviously something kind of weird was going on right now at that point. It looks like my external mic that I've been using was kind of crapping out and then stopped entirely. The system at that point automatically switched to the internal microphone, so I kept talking for a little while, and we'll get back to that in a second. sorry about that weirdness. We'll see if I can get my my main good mic back for the next bit. But that was odd, huh? Okay, back to the show. Because the New York Times snapped him up for the next election cycle, and then now he's at ESPN, ABC, or whatever. And, and he is now paid to do this. He's got a full-time job that is running his 538 site, a major portion of which is election analysis. So he's got himself full-time, and he's got the resources of staff to do all kinds of additional analysis. Sam Wang is a professor, but not in these kinds of studies. He does some sort of biology thing or something. I forget the details of what it is. But the point is, his election analysis stuff is hobby stuff he does on the side. And, you know, and he does a very extensive job on it. He obviously spends a good deal of time on it. But it's not his primary job. And it's something he's essentially doing for fun. He's not making money off it. Or maybe he, gets to write a few articles in a few places, and maybe he gets paid a little bit for those. But it's not his day job. And, Nate Silver is just going after him and going after him and going after him and going after him to try to tear down every single little thing he's done. And I'm just, again, Nate Silver, you're being a dick. Because look, here's your Nate Silver, your model may be better. I don't know. And because of these are probabilistic models, you won't know after the election either. Because, one guy says the Democrats have the Republicans have a 30% chance of winning. One guy says the Republicans have a 60% chance of winning. Guess what? Both of those are toss-ups. And this gets to something I talked about on the podcast a number of weeks ago. This is not, neither one of them is saying that either side has, a 99.9% chance of winning. Either of these are complete toss-ups where either result is very possible. Neither one is all that far from 50-50. One's a little bit in one direction, one's a little bit in the other direction. And yes, Sam Wang is the outlier compared to all of these other guys. So yes, maybe he's the one that's wrong, and maybe there's some methodological reasons for why. But his participation in the debate and the existence of his model improves the understanding of the picture for those who are paying attention, and gives a lot of additional sort of flavor to what's out there. His overall contribution is positive. It would be a less good sort of polling analysis world if Sam Wang was not in it. So, I wish that what was coming out of Nate Silver was a little bit more constructive. Some of this constructive stuff in there, but the tone that he uses when he does this is so, negative. It's not like, hey, great, we're all colleagues in this, we're doing fun stuff, this is interesting, I think there's some problems with your method, let's talk about them, and let's discuss, and blah, 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 and in a friendly way. Instead, they're very much accusatory, and look at this guy, and blah, 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 and it drives me nuts. And of course, all of this has, a personal flavor to it, because, hey, guess what, I'm another one of these guys. I'm not doing the Senate, but, I do election polling stuff for fun. It is not my day job. And I'm, in the final stages of, I'm probably going to, my 2016 election stuff has been out there for a long time. The only thing I haven't done is link to it from my main site and write a few introductory blog posts on what I'm doing and why and things like that. So, and I'll talk a little bit about what I'm doing and why right now, but look, methodologically, oh, and here's Alex. See, I told you, we probably wouldn't get through this. Oh. Okay, so I'm going to pause for a second, and we'll be back, and I'll talk a little bit more.
AfricaFocus.org features high-quality analysis and progressive advocacy on African issues with a particular attention to priority issues affecting the entire continent. The heart of the website is the Africa Focus Bulletin. Other features include regularly updated Africa-related news feeds and a set of country pages with extensive background and links on each African country. If you follow African issues or are even curious, visit AfricaFocus.org today.
And I'm back, and hopefully on the good mic again. Yeah, Alex wasn't really entirely awake, but he got out of bed and he found me, and I took him to his mom, and he went back to sleep. Anyway, where was I? Oh, yeah, my stuff, and again, like Sam Wang, and maybe, you know, Sam Wang at least is a professor somewhere, and he's doing academic things and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, my day job has nothing to do with this stuff at all. And look, there are a lot of methodological things that you could criticize about what I do. And I'm sure, you know, Nate Silver's model for 2016, when it comes out, is going to be so much more sophisticated and have so much more that it takes into account. And, you know, he's doing all kinds of things that arguably are very good things. One, you know, I've only ever done a snapshot, and I'm probably still only going to do a snapshot, for this year. For this election cycle. I don't do a prediction. So what I show is if the election was held today, so he does a forecast instead of a snapshot. He takes into account, rather than any sort of simple polling average, he does something that it weights all of the different polls that are available in different ways. He takes into account the historical accuracy of different pollsters. He takes into account the time distribution of the polls. He takes into account all kinds of things in terms of how he weights the curves and how he does this. And then he goes and does a Monte Carlo type analysis where, you know, he runs simulations of the election to get percent win chances. And all kinds of things, all kinds of very detailed analysis that take into account all kinds of factors. He also, most notably, he takes into account quote unquote fundamentals, so that he where polling data is sparse, and especially early on, factors like, you know, how is the economy doing and things like that factor into the predictions. So it's not just only the polls. It's, hey, here are the polls, but you know what? It's 2 years before the election, and a lot of things can happen, and here's some modeling on sort of what we believe fundamentally affects election outcomes that are going to be taken into account. And as we get closer to the election, the polls will be more and more important, but whereas when we're far away, all these other things matter. What else does he do? Anyway, all kinds of sophisticated things. By comparison, my analysis is dinky and simple. I'm doing I'll run down some of the possible criticisms of it. I'm using averages rather than medians. That's potentially more susceptible to outlier polls. I'm doing a simple 5-poll average rather than doing something that is doing some sort of smoothing of the pool of the polls that takes into account their distribution over time. So, for instance, in some places, my 5-poll average, as we get close to the election, is going to cover only a couple days because there are going to be so many polls in some critical swing states. But in other states that aren't very close, my 5-poll average is going to go back many, many, many years. For instance, in D.C., There, last time around, I think there was one poll the whole election cycle. So with my current method, I'd use that one poll plus four previous elections. So I'd be going back, what, 16 years? In my polling average, and that would be bad. Now, of course, I would argue, well, in the states that matter the most, you're getting a lot more polling. The states that you're taking big time frames are ones where it's unlikely to be changed anyway because it's people aren't polling them because there's no controversy in that state. Everybody knows what it's going to do. Anyway, but there are all kinds of other things. I sometimes move from a 5-poll average to a 6-poll average if the average is right on the boundary between my categories, or if there's a and I don't do this currently, but I plan to add something to if the 5th poll back is actually a tie, there's the 6th and 5th poll back are at the same time, I'll go back and include the 6th as well, rather than arbitrarily choosing one of the polls from that time frame. And okay, that may be fine for where I categorize the polls and then do, here are the close states and here's the not. But I'm also doing a tipping point average, and that generates an inconsistency there. Why are you sometimes using 5 polls and sometimes 6 and sometimes 7 maybe even? And why? That doesn't quite make sense. And all these different time frames. And okay, that's bad. And then also just my main thing of, I generate a band from best case to worst case, basically saying, well, what happens if all of the close states go one way or the other? Of course, all of the close states going one way or another is actually a fairly unlikely scenario. So my band of possible outcomes is probably much wider than the real band of potential outcomes. Now, as long as one candidate is clearly winning, it doesn't really matter. It's clear that they're winning. But if the band includes both candidates winning, okay, then does my model even say anything? Because I'm not generating probabilities. I'm not looking at, how likely is it that, all of these states go one way or the other? And I haven't been doing that. Now, I've considered whether I should do some sort of Monte Carlo simulation and do win probabilities and things like that. But as I think about it, I realize it doesn't match my overall model of just, categorize the states and see which way they go. I would have to, introduce a whole other factor of trying to model, okay, given the polls, what's the actual probability of, do some sort of statistical modeling on that rather than just saying, this is a close state. This is not a close state. So look, what's my reason for doing all of this? My reason for doing all this initially was, well, honestly, to have fun. Because I started this in 2008 because in 2004, I was frustrated because I didn't see this happening. I didn't see these kind of models out there. And I felt frustrated because we did have national polls, but nobody was doing really detailed state-by-state analysis. And so I figured, well, hell, I'll do it myself. And round about the same time, Nate Silver and a bunch of other people also started doing it. And, am I jealous that Nate Silver is the one who ends up with, a huge contract and people fighting over him to work at major corporations to do his stuff? Yes. Yes, I'm jealous. I wish that had been me. But I mean, frankly, he deserves it. What he did with his modeling was more sophisticated and more detailed. And, he posted a lot of analysis stuff too that was probably more sophisticated than mine. But I still think there's a place for what I do because essentially part of the point is actually the simplicity. You can do something really, really easy with a very simple averaging method and get pretty damn good results. Now, it's not perfect. In 2012, I got every state and I got everything right on the Electoral College. But in 2008, I didn't. I think I missed one, something like that. The point is something incredibly simple can give you good results. And there's a question of, okay, you're layering in all of this complexity to do the complex sort of models that Nate Silvers and the others do. And how much more does it really give you? Now, and there are plenty of differences, and there's plenty of value in what Nate Silver, and by no means would say that, you know, hey, everybody should ignore Nate Silver and just pay attention to mine. But what I am saying is it's a useful addition to the discussion, I think. And if Nate Silver started picking on me for all of the methodological choices that I made, you know, I'd feel horrible. Even, and like I said, there are all kinds of methodological things you could nitpick about what I'm doing. And I'm aware of most of them. I'm making a lot of choices I'm making simply because it makes it easier and simpler for me to do the analysis, not necessarily because it's the best possible way to do the analysis. If this was my first full-time job, maybe I'd make different decisions. Maybe I would go for a more complex model. As I'm doing what I'm doing, I keep thinking of ways that I could make it more complicated and ways I can do more. And now that I'm automating more of this as opposed to doing it all in Excel, the possibilities open up of like, oh, I could do that kind of, you know, maybe I could use medians instead of averages. I could just plug this in over here and change that, and let's see how it's different. Maybe I could give a toggle switch to switch from medians to averages. Maybe I could do a Monte Carlo simulation based on some sort of, you know, some sort of way of interpreting the poles that I use in my average to generate probabilities, and then run the Monte Carlo simulation and see what it comes up with, etc. There are all kinds of things I could do. But again, like, I don't know. I've gotten into a lot of what I'm doing, but I keep thinking when I hear the Sam Wang debate is like, Sam Wang's doing this for fun. He is using his knowledge of techniques that he has in his professorial job to dive into it to a level, to a degree that most amateurs can't. I probably couldn't reproduce a lot of what Sam Wang does. At least I wouldn't have come up with it myself. I mean, my tipping point average I use on my site is inspired by Sam Wang's meta margin that he used for the last election, and that he's using for the senatorial stuff too. So I'm definitely like looking at stuff that he does and emulating some of it, but like, but he's doing it for fun. And here comes this guy, you know, with that got a multi-million dollar contract from ESPN to build a website on statistical stuff, and he's picking on him for things. It's like, no, you're doing this wrong. You're doing that wrong. You're doing that wrong. And in a very defensive and angry sort of personal way, it's like, come on, engage with him and have fun with it. And yeah, and if you've got advice, give advice. But oh, that negativity bothers the hell out of me. And you know, I think of, you know, as I'm doing my thing, I'm making lots of choices for a lot of reasons. Some of which is like, I think it would be so fun to look at that. Like one of the other things that I do that fewer of these guys do is show the history over time. Sam Wang does that some. I think Nate Silver even did that a little bit at the end, but it's one of the core pieces of mine. Is it's not just how it is today and here's my prediction for November, but how is the race moving up and down and sideways? I keep getting distracted. Anyway, I just, yeah, if there are all kinds of reasons for what I'm doing. It's fun. I make some choices simply because they're easy and more tractable for me to do. And I may have the vision of, hey, it would be nice to do this kind of analysis here. But then I look at that and say, you know, there's no way I'm going to get to do that in my spare time and generate something. So I'll do this because it's easier. And guess what? The easier thing gives pretty good results anyway. A lot of these other tweaks are second and third order. And if you're talking about something, you know, especially with, you know, this particular Nate Silver, Sam Wang fight here, again, the difference between a 60% chance for the Republicans and a 40% chance for the Republicans is pretty small. They're both toss-ups. And you're not going to experimentally tell which one of you are right. because either one of you allow for a significant probability of both results. And we've only got one sample to try. We can't rerun the election 500 times and see whether it was really 60% or 40%. I mean, So, anyway, I'm rambling now. My own personal website, my target, as it has been for a while, has been to launch around the time of the November election. I'm probably going to take a week off. I will take a week off sometime later this month, just to work on stuff related to that and, you know, add the final bits of polish that I want to the site and maybe add a couple new feature things, but, you know, maybe not. I think all of the critical stuff that I really want on there is already on there. I have a couple additional ideas, but they may or may not come to fruition, before I launch. And then, like I said, write a couple blog posts announcing what's going on. And then it'll be out there, and then I'll start posting updates when state categories change and things like that. The main interpretation at this point really is that for most of the candidates, we're still in the process of getting enough polls to understand where they really are, as opposed to the generic results from just averaging the last five presidential elections. We'll see. Okay, enough of that. We'll take a break. We'll be back with something else. Bring me the elephant. 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 Bring me the
account information.
Okay, I'm back. Next up, enough yammering about my own website stuff. Presidential security. So obviously this situation with the Secret Service has blown up in the news the last few weeks, prompted by a series of high-profile leaks, mostly to the Washington Post, although now they've started to be some in some other places as well. Basically, just outlining incident after incident after incident where there have been gaps in presidential security, potentially avoidable gaps, and criticism about how security is being run. And obviously the most recent one was the guy who ran into the White House last week. But there was an incident in 2011 where somebody actually shot at the White House, and it was reported at the time, but it took them a few days before they even admitted somebody shot at the White House, as opposed to it being incidental fire from something else that was going on, as if that wasn't still a problem. There's issue of a person with a criminal record being allowed to get on an elevator with President Obama with a gun. More recently, there was just a report today about a situation where somebody impersonating a congressman got into an event with Obama just a few days ago as well. Now, obviously, like, they're just a few incidents, and I bet you if you did a deep dive on the Secret Service during any presidency, going back the last few presidents, there were undoubtedly misses and places where, you know, somebody got through security, this happened, that happened, and we've never heard about it. That's not to say that these are good. I mean, all the reporting I've seen of this seems to be that there are significant problems within the Secret Service. I mean, if you remember a year ago, there was also the issue of, whenever when Secret Service going on foreign trips and getting drunk and hiring prostitutes and things like that, but potentially compromising presidential security by not being as, professional with those things as they should be. I get the feeling that the immediate cause here is that over the last few weeks, there's somebody at the Secret Service who's been increasingly pissed off by what they've been seeing and increasingly frustrated and not able to get anybody to take them seriously. And so they just started leaking to the press, leaking and leaking and leaking and leaking. And with all of these things made public, of course, the director of the Secret Service had to resign. They'll be revamping things. And they brought back someone out of retirement to be the temporary head of the Secret Service, but they're still looking for a permanent person, and they may be looking at people external who will be willing to come in and sort of clean house and fix things up. But another piece that's been because of all this press on it. And I'm not saying any of this should not have been reported, but there's definitely a worry here that, look, over the last few weeks, we've had report after report after report after report of Obama's Secret Service protection not being that great. And you kind of think that's going to inspire people to test it and try things. And, if somebody was thinking, hey, let's go after the president and previous had been like, yeah, no, security's too tight. Now they might be worth a shot. Maybe literally. And obviously I think that would be, not a good thing if it happened. When you get all of these reports, the one thing you want to hope is happening right now is that independent of any long-term investigations, fixes, blah, 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 all the protective detail should be like doubled right now. They should just be, throwing additional resources at it for the moment, simply because, the threat environment has to be worse now than it was a few weeks ago, simply because of all the reporting about presidential security. And so they should be switching things up quickly, and all of the long-term investigations definitely need to happen, but short-term things need to be changing as well. And I presume they are doing that. Because fundamentally, agree with them, don't agree with them, whatever. The last thing that this country needs is something violent happening to the president or his family. That would be horrible. Right now Obama's approval ratings are pretty low. Even the people who voted for him are somewhat disillusioned as to what he's been doing. The people who didn't vote for him never liked him. But nevertheless, anything happening to a president is a traumatic national event. It causes all kinds of disruption. I mean, even look at the attempted assassination of Ronald Reagan in 1980. He was not able to fully perform his duties as president for quite a few months. And we sort of had, but we never, it was never officially turned over to Bush under the 22nd Amendment, but it probably should have been. Was it the 22nd Amendment? Whatever the amendment is that lets the vice president take over temporarily when the president is disabled. In any case, it's been remarkable, all of the things if you read all of these articles, all of the specific things that the Secret Service themselves pushing to cut their staff and reduce the protective details, and Congress actually saying, you know, we're not going to cut it as much as you want to cut it. We're going to give you a little bit more than that. We have the head of the Secret Service insisting on protections being scaled back at certain public events in order to make the president more visible and engaged to the public, which, okay, that's a laudable goal. I mean, she was quoted with some stupid quote about being more like Disneyland, which, come on. But, you know, accessibility for the executive actually is important. Getting him out of the bubble is important, blah, blah, blah. But it sounds like there are situations where the long time sort of people who'd been with the Secret Service for quite some time were saying, this is inadequate. We're taking a significant risk by doing this. And, the response was basically, okay. And actually, let's take even more risk, because we want to do these trade-offs differently. You can't protect the president from every possible thing. Bottom line, sort of any thing like this is, if you have someone determined enough with the right resources, they can get through whatever you put in their way, period. But you have to have a reasonable balance, and it sounds like the balance has gone a little on the lax side, because you also had this latest thing where the guy ran into the White House. Apparently there was an alarm box that was just turned off because the White House staff were concerned that it made too much noise when it gave false alarms periodically, and so they just turned it off. Now, false alarms, of course, is also a problem. If it's having false alarms all the time, that also degrades its relevance as a good signal, because people will say, it's another false alarm. Anyway, just a worrying set of news articles to point out. Let's hope they get this sort of in a... Get this fixed up. We don't want something happening to the president or his family. Please, no. I mean, as much as I must admit, it would make, election coverage and everything else for the next couple of years even more interesting. Let's say, president is killed or incapacitated. Biden becomes president. He has to appoint a vice president. What if he appoints Clinton? How does that change the dynamics of 2016? Or anything, or does it increase his own run? He appoints Clinton as vice president and then announces that he's running himself, but she, and he wants her as his running mate. All kinds of crazy stuff could happen, but it's not worth it. as much as I'm a news junkie, it is not worth it. I would rather not see, something bad happen to the president. It makes good fiction, it makes good movies. I don't really want to see it in real life. Thank you very much. So, Secret Service, please do your job. It's also interesting. Most of these incidents, whenever somebody breaks into the White House or shoots the White House, or somebody crashed a plane into the White House once, a small plane, and it turns out, but all of these things, they always are like, this happened when the president wasn't home. President wasn't home. The president wasn't home. Now, you got to wonder, do these things ever happen when the president is home? I mean, this last one, apparently some of the family was home. But is it just a mere coincidence that all of these things happen when the president isn't home? Or are there more that have not been reported that happened when the president has been home? I'm assuming for the moment that they're in none of these cases, they're not lying and the president was home, but it just seems weird that almost all the time when we hear these things, the president was not at the White House. And I recognize the president is not at the White House a lot. So maybe we could look at, I have not done this statistical analysis. It's tempting to go back and look for these incidents and you know, what percentage of them was the president home and what percentage of them was he not? And how does that compare to the percentage of the time the president actually is home and is not? And, you know, this is another one of those things. If my full-time job was some sort of data journalism thing, I'd be like, that sounds like a cool project. I'll go spend a couple days on it. But I don't have a couple days to spend on researching that. Sorry. Anyway, we're ready to take another break, and we'll be back, and we'll talk about, Ebola or something when we come back. Back after this.
Classic celebrates the classic horror and science fiction films from the silent era through the 1960s, and retro TV horror from the 1950s to the 1970s. Visit creepyclassics.com for all your classic video needs. And when you buy something, tell Ron that the curmudgeons say hello.
Okay, we're back. Is it Ebola time? I guess it's Ebola time. So I don't really have a lot to say about this in terms of the crisis itself. In terms of the coverage, I guess one of the things that's frustrating here is that on the one hand, we've got breathless, oh my God, panic type of coverage, specifically about anything that has this coming to the U.S. We've obviously got the one case that was diagnosed here this week from somebody who traveled to the country. We've had a couple other people that were brought to the U.S. for treatment. People are all like, oh my God, everybody's going to die. And that is probably very, very overblown and yes, this last guy, they estimated he contacted potentially 80 people. They're talking to all of those people. They're monitoring closely, blah, blah, blah. There's a chance of spread. But frankly, in the U.S., we've got the health resources in place that we can deal with the cases that come up. Isolate people appropriately and mitigate the spread fairly vigorously. And as is pointed out time and time and time and time again by everybody who talks about this, it's really hard to spread. You know, it is bodily fluids only. It's not airborne, et cetera. So on the one hand, you've got all this breathless sort of panic type coverage that you see here with people sort of freaking out about it and that really need to just calm down. At the same time, you've got a significant real crisis going on in West Africa where all of those resources aren't necessarily in place. They don't have the necessary resource and coverage to take care of the people who are sick while taking all the necessary precautions and making sure that, you know, when there are deaths, the bodies are handled in a safe way. And a lot of that is missing. So you are getting the spread there. And, you know, there has been an increase just in the last couple of weeks of attention being given to that and resources being sent in. There's a good argument to be made that it's about a month too late to really have to shut things down in the way that they could have. And instead, we're still in for a pretty large outbreak, with potentially, hundreds of thousands of people affected in the worst case before this gets under control. I guess, well, the worst case is zombie apocalypse, blah, blah, blah. But, let's talk realistically here. The CDC's estimates are on the order of a few hundred thousand potentially, which is huge. And it's a lot of it is simply because the resources aren't present to be able to stop it properly and treat it properly when it happens. I guess that is ramping up now, but you hear at the same time proposals to do things like just shut off all air travel to the region and things like that, which, of course, what's the result of that? You hamper people getting in to help. Yes, you hamper people getting out too, and maybe there's some infected people, but again, the West is better able to handle those cases anyway. The right answer isn't throw a big wall around West Africa and, you know, whoever dies, dies. Oh, well, at least it's not us. Like I said, things are ramping up. Hopefully some additional support will be provided where it's necessary. But it still looks like this is going to be pretty bad. It's already pretty bad, but it looks like it's going to get worse, quite a bit worse. And it's not a good thing. I mean, what else do I have to say? I mean, hopefully we will be putting the resources we need to onto this to protect not just the U.S. I mean, obviously we do want to avoid having sort of a major problem here, but also to help in the places where it already is. And I think it's incredibly narrow-minded to focus only on, let's keep this out of Texas or, whatever. That's not the right focus. The focus is, there's a disease that's spreading rapidly. Let's see what we can do about it, wherever it may be. Now, you do want to balance against everything else in terms of, how many deaths have actually been caused? Well, in the U.S., so far, no Ebola deaths whatsoever. Zero, zip, zilch. Meanwhile, I saw a post that says, in the same time period, a number of people have died from playing high school football, let alone number of people killed in car accidents or shot or whatever. So, at least in the U.S. specifically, it's still a fairly small problem. Globally, obviously, it's bigger, but even globally, right now, it's only a few thousand people, which is tiny compared to all sorts of other causes of death. So why pay attention? And of course, the reason you pay attention anyway, despite the small numbers today, is because since it is a contagious disease that can spread, you want to stop it before it gets bigger. So you do have to pay attention to it in a way that's disproportionate to the raw number of cases that we've already had to date, compared to other possible threats. And how do you balance that precisely to make sure you're giving it the right amount of attention versus everything else you could be paying attention to? Like even now, even in the worst places this what's the best use of time, effort, and money? Is it really Ebola, or is it more malaria efforts or HIV efforts or some other disease? I don't know the answer to that, because that all depends on, how well we think we have growth rates under control or not. And the reason that Ebola is getting the attention it has is that so far the growth is not checked. It's still accelerating. And so that's why it's as the concern it is. And so put the resources on it that we need to. And I think that, particularly speaking, places where the U.S. can help, we should. This is not the kind of issue like, going into war to protect somebody, throwing some money and some doctors at something. I can get behind that. And in the end, yes, it probably does do us good as well from a purely selfish point of view as well. But I don't think we should rely on that, for saying that, yes, it's good to get involved. This is something where there's probably in comparison to everything else we do for a fairly low cost, we can probably have a fairly significant benefit. And so therefore we should do it. And hopefully minimize this as much as possible. We'll see. Hopefully this isn't something where, 6 months from now, we're still talking about the Ebola crisis and how it's spreading and how it's all over the place and, you know, huge numbers of people dead. It may well be where we're going, but we should do what we can to avoid it. Okay, let's take a break. Back after this exciting message.
You're in the Valley, AM 1620 and LigonierRadio.com. This is where you'll find your favorite songs. Everybody's doing a brand new dance now. Come on, baby. Let's do
the twist. Well, they got a new dance and it goes like this.
Classic music for a classic American town, AM 1620, and in stereo at LigonierRadio.com, The Valley.
And I'm back, and I now have an awake Alex playing next to me here. But the last thing I wanted to talk about today is just podcasts and listening to them and speed that you listen to them. So now almost every podcast playing software out there, if not everyone, has an adjustable speed on it. So you can listen to it at 1x, like the actual speed it was recorded and presented at, or you can speed it up. And most of these offer like 1.25 times, 1.5 times, 2 times. Some of them even offer 3 times. There's a little bit, debate out there. Some of them, like, those labels aren't actually accurate, so they'll, like, say it's 2 times, but it's really 1.5 times, but whatever. It doesn't matter for the purposes of this discussion. You know, I tweeted earlier this week that I had found a new podcast application called iCatcher with an I, not an EYE, and an exclamation mark at the end. Anyway, and I've switched to it, basically. It's got the current version of it on iOS 8 has a few little bugs. It crashes sometimes, which is kind of annoying. They say there's an update in progress for iOS 8 that hopefully will address a bunch of those issues. The syncing wasn't 100% perfect, but whatever. It was very good. The reason I went to this app actually has nothing to do with the speed at which you play podcasts, but was is the first one I've found that has a randomized feature. And for me, that's an absolute killer thing because, you know, I'm crazy about like the podcasts and hearing things and blah, blah, blah. So I subscribe to over 500 podcasts. Now, that does not mean that I listen to 500 podcasts regularly and religiously all the time, every episode. By no means. You know, many of these podcasts are daily podcasts. There's no way I keep up with that. Many of them are weekly. There's no way I can't even keep up with the monthly podcasts. No, the reason I do this is that I want to hear a wide variety of things. And, you know, basically whenever I hear about a new podcast that might be interested, I add it. And then, you know, if I hear it a few times and I don't like it, I'll remove it from my list. And I'm probably a bit too high at 500 at the moment. I probably need to start culling quite a few of these. And I have actually been in that process. But anyway, the point is, my process is not that I try to keep up with these. It's that when I want to listen to something like this in the car, you know, I want to get something different almost every time. And, you know, there are some favorites that, you know, okay, it would be nice to hear that every time. But, you know, for the most part, I want a variety. I want to be hearing from a whole bunch of different voices on a whole bunch of different topics. I follow ones on news and current events. I follow ones on science. I follow ones on a whole bunch of things that I have a bunch of book review ones because I'm always looking for new ideas of things to read, even though I don't actually get to anywhere near as much of that either. Anyway, so in every previous podcast application I've used, you know, you've been able to sort your podcast from new to old or from old to new or things like that. But you would then play sequentially through that list. So my previous method was to sort of sort it and then start and then sort of start going through chronologically from like today's podcast, moving to older and older and older podcasts. And then when I got to the end, I'd cycle back to the beginning again. And meanwhile, a lot of podcasts that are updated daily or even weekly, the only way I'd ever hear them is if I happen to restart that cycle at the point where at the time of day or week that those things were coming out. The random thing lets me do much more like what I want to do, which is I've got my list of 500 podcasts. I get into the car, hit the button. It picks one at random, always the most recent of whatever. I don't keep back issues. I don't worry about that. You know, give me the most recent of whatever podcast it is. And I listen to it. And 5 minutes in, if I'm bored, I hit next and I pick another random one. And if, you know, I consistently notice I'm always, you know, fast forwarding on one and skipping it, then I'll just drop it from the list. But anyway, iCatcher wasn't my point. My point was I posted about how I'd switched to iCatcher and, you know, and comparing the various software. And I'd actually gotten to this from a link in Overcast, which is a new podcast player that I had had a lot of hopes for. But it didn't have the random feature, and also it didn't have streaming, which is kind of critical for me. With 500 podcasts, I can't download and keep all 500 and be updating them all the time. I only want to download it when I'm actually listening to it. But Overcast had... one of the things that it's gotten a lot of attention for is it actually has a list of other podcasting applications that is in there that says, hey, if this isn't for you, try one of these. And I thought I'd already tried like all the podcast apps for iOS, but I hadn't seen this one before and I saw it on the list. I'm like, oh, I'll go check that out. And here you go. It had the randomized feature. And the guy who writes Overcast responded on Twitter saying, hey, I'm glad, you know, I should be sad that you're using something else and not mine, but I'm glad that you found it through my app, and great, use what's best for you. And, you know, I replied back that I really like some of the features in his app. He's got a much better, like, his app, instead of just doing 1.5 times or 2 times, does a smart thing where it actually removes gaps. Like, right now, I'm talking a little bit slow and I left a couple gaps in what I was saying, and it would automatically remove those gaps and save time that way, as well as potentially speeding up, which was actually quite nice. I liked that feature a lot. Anyway, I responded that I liked the smart speed, it's just the other things were missing, blah, blah, blah. And so a bunch of other random people started jumping into the conversation at this time. And one guy in particular, about how, you know, he thought it was really arrogant and obnoxious when people listen to their podcasts at higher than the normal speed, because it represents some sort of, you know, the person's not talking fast enough for you. So there's something wrong with that person, and it's insulting to the owner of the podcast to speed up their stuff. And of course, I got into a sort of a little argument about that. Look, because I just can't really understand that viewpoint, because, you know, yes, okay, if I'm talking to somebody in person and I say, dude, you're talking too slow, please speed up, I realize that might seem like a little rude. And it might be a little rude to be like, you know, hey, look, my brain operates so damn fast. You know, you say the first two words of what you're going to say. I know the rest of your sentence, so I'm just going to cut you off here and move on, because, you know, I know what you're going to say. Okay, that's a little bit rude in person. I admit that. But look, the reality of listening to something recorded is this. First of all, it's not a two-way conversation. It's a recording. You're able to manipulate it in any way you want. So why the hell not adjust it to whatever speed suits you for whatever reason. And it's absolutely nothing against the person who recorded it in the first place. I mean, look, here's a fundamental reality of how humans process information. Speaking, at least for most people, is slower than thinking. You can...
Yes, Alex? Yes?
Anyway, to continue, speaking...
Daddy. Yes, what? Yes, I see that. Very nice. Okay, I'm going to continue, okay?
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay. Speaking is slower than thinking. So most people can process information faster than most people speak. And I'm sure there's some exceptions out there, that, and in those cases, you will slow things down. But if I've got complete control over the recording, it is not in any way saying that I'm arrogant or I think I'm better than you or anything else if I speed up your recording to make it more, and I use the word more comfortable. Now, anyway, I use the word more comfortable, and they called me out for that and said, come on, admit it. It's just speed. You just want to be able to listen to more faster so that you can listen to three things in a day instead of two. And I said, okay, that's part of it. Yes, I want to be able to, you know, listen to more during my commute than I would otherwise. Ouch. It's hot. His mom just brought us food, by the way, which is what's going on now. But yes, that's part of it. But part of it is actually that, you know, for a lot of these podcasts, if I listen to them, especially now that I'm used to it, and I admit, like, it took, well, a couple minutes for me to get used to the speed. But once I'm used to listening to things accelerated, if I listen to things at normal speed, it feels incredibly slow. I feel so impatient. I feel like, you know, this is boring and I can't deal with it and I can't wait for this. And so, yeah, I speed it up and it's more comfortable for me. And I listen to two times is too fast for me. Like, I try to listen to things at two times speed and it goes past too fast and I can't process it all. But 1.5 seems to be just perfect for me. I listen to the things, I get every word, I understand every word, I'm not missing anything, but it just picks up the pace a little bit. And yes, I get in more, but it's also, you know, my mind doesn't start tuning out in between just because the thing's moving along so slowly.
Yours.
Okay, you don't like that? Okay. I'll have it.
That's Mio.
It's what?
Mio.
It's Mio? Yeah. Okay. It's oatmeal with cinnamon on it.
No, it's Mio with cinnamon.
Okay, it's Mio with cinnamon on it. Anyway, I don't understand the objection. I really don't. Like, I've encouraged people, and I encourage people again. Like, you know, Yvonne and I, and certainly me and my solo shows, you know, I ramble a bit. This show is going to be, you know, like an hour and 15 minutes, hour 20 minutes, something like that. If you can listen to it in 45, so much the better. You know, now, could we use an editor that actually goes in and, you know, takes all the times that I repeat myself five times and cuts out all but the first time? Okay, that might make the show even better. But we don't have the resources to do that. And also, this could be for different people. It could be different on each individual podcast. Like, some podcasts, maybe you can speed up two times. Maybe some podcasts, the guy's already talking really fast and you only want to speed it up a little bit. Or maybe the guy talks so fast, you want to leave it at regular speed. And also, of course, I listen to a few music podcasts. I don't speed those up generally because it's music and it changes it entirely if you speed it up into something different. Whereas if the main thing I'm trying to get out of something is what words did the guy say, I can hear the words just as well if it's going a little bit faster. And no offense intended. I mean, I'm sorry. And it's not like I can do this because I've got a super brain and I can listen to things faster. Like I said, almost anybody could, you know? And I suppose this also has a difference of, you know, are you the type of person who is good learning and paying attention, you know, with your ears as opposed to your eyes, as opposed to something else? Like, there may be people where the speeding up, it does bother them. Okay, then don't do it. Or even slow it down if that helps. You know, there may be people who are happy to read quickly but don't want to hear quickly, or vice versa. And the point is, it's recorded. You've got tools that let you manipulate that recording. why wouldn't you do anything and everything that makes you happier with the experience of listening to it? Make it faster if it makes you happy. Make it slower if it makes you happy. Adjust the pitch if you want to. Make it so I talk like a chipmunk. Make it, you know, so that there's an echo or not an echo, or, you know, use the equalizer to adjust however you want. Or chop it up and remove the gaps. Or, you know, I'm sure before time moves along so long, we'll have improved automatic speech recognition and translation. So have something automatically translate it. And, you know, listen to my podcast in German. You know, all of these things could potentially be possible technologically. So why not? You know, it's not like listening to exactly the thing that the person said and exactly the way they said it and exactly the pacing they said it, you know, is the only pure way to listen to one of these things. Now, I also listen to audiobooks sped up at 1.5. And I can actually hear the argument, you know, like I keep a music at one time, I could see the argument for things like dramas or acting or things where people are doing things where, you know, the pacing actually indicates, you know, where the actor has carefully chosen their pace in order to give the effect they want for the character they're talking about. Okay, I can see in those kinds of situations that you might want to, you might gain something by actual speed. But even there, I see that for like dramas and stuff. But if it's an audiobook where fundamentally someone is reading the words of the book to you, and of course, you know, sometimes the people who do that, you know, add little voices and add inflections and things like that to make it sort of a pseudo drama, but they're still reading the book, the words out of the book, and it's all about the words. Whereas, you know, if you've got like a truly dramatic presentation, then there's really, there's a performance there as well. And okay, maybe I can see some of those arguments for those kind of things. But come on, for a generic podcast, for, you know, if I'm listening to, you know, two people yammering on about something for an hour, no, I can speed it up. And my brain can even, you know, once you're used to listening at that speed, you still hear those inflections and changes and things like that. Anyway, I don't understand, like, but there is this group of people out there who are actually offended by people who listen to their podcasts sped up. I can understand why you wouldn't want to do it yourself. I don't understand why anybody would be offended by it. Come on, you know, absorb your material in any way that feels best to you. Okay, I think we're done. And that was my last topic of the day. So we're going to close it up. Thank you again for listening to yet another Curmudgeon's Corner. I'm Samuel Minter. You can reach me at by email at abelsmay@abelsmay.com or on Twitter at abelsmay. Yvonne couldn't be here, but you can get him at @iambo on Twitter as well. And hopefully he'll be back with us next week. In the meantime, everybody, you know, tell your friends to listen and, you know, send us feedback and have a great week. We'll talk to you later. Goodbye.